Ballroom Dance.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on August 28th, 2005, WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. And it is a lovely summer day here in the heartland. Today, we've got a terrific live show for you. We're going to be speaking with Professor Norman G. Finkelstein, who's a professor of political theory at DePaul University in Chicago. We're going to be talking with Professor Finkelstein about not only his new book, Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history, but also on his earlier work and the general political controversy surrounding his work, his research, and his arguments concerning the Holocaust, concerning anti-Semitism, and in particular concerning Israel and Palestine. I think it's going to be a terrific show. I think you'll enjoy it. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The practice of payola in radio broadcasting is back in the spotlight following Sony BMG's settlement with the state of New York last month over an investigation that uncovered massive bribery in the form of both cash and gifts to radio stations for airplay of Sony BMG artists. The New York Attorney General's office continues to investigate three other major label conglomerates, EMI, Universal, and Warner Music Group. But what's happening to those radio stations who rolled in the payola? While the FCC could at the very least go after those stations identified in the New York investigation, it shows no real signs of doing so. And it might be a while before any action happens. The FCC's last payola-related enforcement effort occurred way back in 1998 when it issued two $4,000 fines against stations in Michigan and Texas. Interestingly, this month brought more headaches for Sony's media promotions practices, as it will pay more than $1 million to settle a class action lawsuit in California involving the company's use of a fictitious critic to pitch its movies. Once the reviews were unmasked as patently fake, Sony argued unsuccessfully in court that it had a First Amendment right to lie as part of its marketing scheme.
Yet another sign that technology moves faster than law. A scant 2 months after the Supreme Court ruled file-sharing services could theoretically be held liable for the trading of copyrighted material, software developers are testing advancements to make it harder for the movie and music industries to track the activity. Programmers in the U.S. and Ireland are working on new technologies to create what are called trusted networks that resist industry surveillance, intrusion, and the pollution of file-sharing systems with corrupt files and programs. If media companies cannot demonstrate that copyright infringing use is taking place on a network, it makes it much more difficult to sue it into submission. And if the users of such networks cannot be easily identified, the legal risks involved with file sharing decrease.
Last year, the FCC set a new record for enforcement against broadcast indecency. This year, there's been no action on the indecency front, but that may be about to change. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin has brought a well-known conservative Christian family values activist into the agency's Office of Strategic Planning and Policy Analysis as a special advisor. The new hire is Penny Nance, who founded the Kids First Coalition, which lobbies in Washington against pornography, abortion, gay rights, and peer-to-peer file sharing. She's also been involved with Concerned Women for America and the Center for Reclaiming America, both which explicitly advocate for the use of biblical principles in government regulation. While neither Nance nor the FCC will talk about her new job, they may be saving their energies for a major anti-indecency offensive, which could begin with mass action on as many as 4 dozen indecency complaints. Such a tactic would certainly generate a lot of hype on the topic, boosting its political importance beyond what the topic truly deserves, given that indecency complaints to the FCC are down dramatically this year compared to last by more than half.
Fox News may be coming to a TV station near you. Roger Ailes, former PR man for Presidents Nixon, Reagan, and Bush I, and co-creator of the Fox News cable channel, just got promoted to chairman of Fox television stations. He'll oversee all programming on Fox's 35 stations, as well as an arm of the company's TV production studios. This is on top of Ailes-backed plans to start up a Fox-themed cable channel focused exclusively on business news. In all, Roger Ailes will now be responsible for projects that generate as much as 1/3 of parent company News Corporation's annual revenue.
Telecommunications companies continue to consolidate, and the deals just seem to get bigger. First, SBC announced it would buy AT&T for $16 billion. Then Verizon announced the $7 billion purchase of MCI. But the latest action involves cell phones, resulting in the merger of Sprint with Nextel Communications for a hefty $35 billion. This reduces the number of national cell phone service providers from 5 to 4 and gives the new company a combined subscriber base of about 44 million. And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact. A summer survey of the readers of Media Life magazine, whose primary audience is those who buy and sell advertising, found that a full 3/4 of those who responded think further media consolidation is, quote, absurd. 80% believe consolidation hurts the quality of content around which to sell ads. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. August 28th, 2005. The studio's here in Campbell Hall. And on the phones joining us for the next hour on Media Matters, we've got a terrific guest for you. Norman Finkelstein is the author of the international bestseller, The Holocaust Industry, which has been translated into 18 foreign languages, has written several books, and has a brand new book out, Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history, a book that has been described by Publishers Weekly as, quote, a meticulously researched expose of the corruption of scholarship on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Norman G. Finkelstein received his doctorate in 1988 from the Department of Politics at Princeton University, where he wrote a thesis on the theory of Zionism. He currently teaches political theory at DePaul University in Chicago. Norman, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I very much appreciate your joining us. And I think there are probably some of our listeners who are a little bit familiar with your new book, because it's already gotten a bit of publicity. Why don't you, if you would please, give a brief synopsis of what Beyond Chutzpah is about?
Basically, the content of the book is divided into two parts. The first part of the book deals with what's called the new anti-Semitism, which I claim is fundamentally, a fabrication designed to immunize Israel from criticism. There's no basis for the claim that there is a rampant new anti-Semitism afoot in the world, at least no basis for, as far as I can tell, from searching through the documentary record. And the second part of the book is an analysis of Israel's human rights record, in which I juxtapose the claims that Professor Alan Dershowitz of Harvard Law School makes in his book, The Case for Israel, in which he states and then pretends to document that Israel's human rights record in the occupied territories is generally superb. I juxtapose what he claims and his purported documentation against what all mainstream human rights organizations show in their exhaustive and meticulously documented, not to mention the voluminous reports over the past 20 years. And the main conclusion I draw from that is that Israel's human rights record, as at least as one can judge from these voluminous human rights reports, its record is abysmal in the occupied territories, and that Alan Dershowitz's book, The Case for Israel, is a fraud.
Now, you also, if I'm not mistaken, discuss Professor Dershowitz's reliance upon an earlier book for much of his evidence. Is that right?
Yeah. In the course of researching Alan Dershowitz's book, I came across a large amount of material which sounded familiar to me, namely material which was lifted from another fraud, namely Joan Peters's From Time Immemorial, which came out about 20 years ago now in May 1984. And I think it's fair to say that I played the instrumental role in exposing that fraud. So it wasn't It wasn't just happenstance that when I was reading through Dershowitz's book, I suddenly realized I was reading Joan Peters's book. I knew the Joan Peters book very well.
Now, for listeners who aren't familiar with Joan Peters' book and her argument, what was her main thesis in that book?
Peters' book is very easily summarized. Her main thesis was that Palestine was empty on the eve of Zionist colonization. The Zionist settlers came, made the desert bloom, and then all these Arabs from neighboring countries surreptitiously entered Palestine to take advantage of the economic opportunities Jews created, and then claimed to be indigenous to the land when in fact they weren't.
Now, is that not true?
There's no evidence whatever, and no scholar takes the claim or Joan Peters' book. I won't even say they don't take it seriously. That would be putting it in negative. But to put it in the affirmative, it's universally regarded as a fraud.
We're talking to Norman Finkelstein today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're discussing his brand-new book, Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history. We're also discussing the corpus of his work, which now includes several books, much of which has dealt with Israel and Palestine, anti-Semitism, and the Holocaust. And if you'd like to call in with a question or comments, the phone number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Finkelstein, what would you say most Americans don't know about Israel and Palestine that they ought to know? What are the things from your experience as an American talking to people on the street or students in your classes, the elementary facts or just anything at all that people really don't understand about what's going on over there?
Well, I think the main thing, there are two aspects. There's the human rights question and there's the historical question. I think it's fair to say that most Americans don't know anything about the historical dimension of historical conflicts generally. Excuse me, they don't know much about the historical dimension of political conflicts generally. So in that case, it wouldn't be correct to say that the knowledge on Israel-Palestine is somehow an aberration. I think, you know, in general, and I'm not saying this in a kind of contemptuous way, I'm just saying factually that I doubt that most Americans know the historical background to most political conflicts in the world. But I think there's a separate issue, and the separate issue is the human rights dimension. And the human rights dimension, it goes beyond ignorance. It's a case of calculated misinformation, disinformation, propaganda, which is churned out by Israel and its official lobbyists, as well as its effective lobbyists in the media. And so, you know, basic questions, let's just take one which would, I think, strike most of your listeners, not necessarily your listeners, but would be useful for Americans to know. There was all of this discussion this past week about the forced evacuation of 6,000 settlers from Gaza. And the New York Times became, for about a week, it became the Gaza Times, with each day these huge photographs, two or three full pages in the paper about this great historical trauma, and drama unfolding in the Gaza. Well, you know, in the last 4 years, according to Human Rights Reports, about 2,200 homes were systematically demolished by Israel in the Gaza Strip. About 10,000 or so people were left homeless. I don't think anyone knows anything about that. I don't think anyone knows that Israel systematically destroys homes on a weekly basis in the Gaza Strip in the West Bank on all sorts of pretexts, and have left at this point tens of thousands of people homeless, and in short periods of time. I'm not talking about tens of thousands who have been left homeless over a long duration. We're talking about in the last 4 years in Gaza, it was about 10,000 people who were left homeless, a little over 2,000 homes which were destroyed. And rather differently than the case of the Gaza settlers, let's just take some of the fundamental difference. The Gaza settlers were there illegally. They were illegal settlers under international law. That's number one. Number two, the Gaza settlers received between $200,000 and $500,000 compensation for their homes. The Palestinians received a tent from UNRWA, weren't allowed to resettle on the place where their homes were destroyed. And under Israeli law, which is in violation, incidentally, of international law, weren't entitled to any compensation from the State of Israel. Number three, the Gaza settlers were given months of notice about their homes being destroyed. In the case of the Gaza residents of their own homes, their homes were destroyed usually within 15 minutes of an Israeli bulldozer suddenly appearing on their doorstep in the middle of the night, which is the way homes are destroyed there. So, you know, if you had any sort of even a pretense of balance, it would seem from a human rights point of view, from a moral point of view, from every point of view, the political point of view, the drama and trauma that Palestinians face every day in the occupied territories would be as worthy of news coverage as that of the illegal settlers in Gaza. Well, obviously that didn't happen.
Yeah, we moved very quickly, Professor Finkelstein, from a discussion of what Americans don't know to a discussion of how the media has covered this, since that's where most Americans are going to learn about this.
Well, there's nothing, you know, I hate to sound like I'm being cavalier or I'm being hyperbolic, but I honestly don't believe you can learn anything about the Israel-Palestine conflict from reading, say, the New York Times. Let's just take two stories from the last week. There's a story by Greg Meyer on the wall that's being built in the occupied territories. So he has a line there. He says, until recently, Palestinians have been able to move freely between Ramallah, Jerusalem, and Bethlehem. I had to think to myself, really? Doesn't Greg Meyer know that no Palestinian is allowed in Jerusalem? That since 1993, in order for a Palestinian to enter Jerusalem, they have to have a special permit, which virtually no Palestinian is eligible for? My best friend in the occupied territories, who I go to live with every year from Fawar camp right outside to Hebron, his name is Musa Abu Hashesh. He works for an Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem. He hasn't seen Jerusalem since 1993, 12 years. And now this guy comes along, the reporter from the New York Times, and he tells us Palestinians until recently could move freely between Ramallah, Jerusalem, and Bethlehem. Let's leave aside all the roadblocks, all the checkpoints, everything which makes a trip like that a nightmare for a Palestinian. Let's leave all of that aside. Let's just look at the law. No Palestinian is allowed in Jerusalem. And yet this imbecile, to put it generously, we'll assume he's not a pathological liar, this imbecile says Palestinians can freely move through Jerusalem. Then you open up the Times today, Steve Erlinger. He has a story on Gaza. And a blood-curdling threat by an anonymous Hamas leader. Okay, he quotes a Hamas leader that says, if you're going to try to disarm Hamas, Israel is going to be turned into hell. All right, maybe it's blood-curdling. They say that about every 5 minutes, Hamas, they have a report like that. And then he starts with, there's a demonstration in Gaza. There are children in the demonstration wearing military uniforms. There are women covered in all in black. I mean, it might as well have been written by the Israeli press agency.
We're talking.
You don't learn anything. They talk about children. Well, what about all the children that the settlers were using to block the Israeli army from evicting them, using them as human shields in front of the Israeli army? That's okay. That's permissible. In fact, all the children that the settlers dragged into what was clearly a war zone. For the past 4 years, the settlers have brought their children into the West Bank and Gaza in the midst of what was effectively a war zone. Isn't that using children? isn't that exploiting children? Or how the settlers typically take their children and put them in front of themselves when the army tries to prevent them from doing something, an illegal action. That's not using kids. Only the Palestinians, the Gazans, use their children. Or let's just take one last example. The New York Times' resident expert on the Israel-Palestine conflict is his fellow named Ethan Bronner. Ethan Bronner sits on their editorial board, and he writes all of the Times' editorials on the Israel-Palestine conflict. So Ethan Bronner writes a review of Alan Dershowitz's The Case for Israel, and he thinks this is a wonderful book, a brilliant book, he tells the readers of the New York Times. The book is a sheer fraud. What does it tell you when the New York Times' resident expert authority on the Israel-Palestine conflict, the fellow who writes the editorials, doesn't have the vaguest idea, doesn't have a clue as to the actual historical record or the human rights record of Israel in occupied territories? Anyone who knew anything about the topic, I mean a fifth-grade knowledge, would know immediately from reading Dershowitz's book, assuming he wrote it, and being generous and calling it a book, would know that Dershowitz's book is sheer nonsense. But the Times gives it a rave review, which tells you something about their intellectual, moral, and political standards.
Now, Norman Finkelstein, is the Times an anomaly, or do you think this is a pattern across the news media in the United States?
I would say, as compared, well, let's be clear about something. You know, we are fortunate. I'm not going to, you know much more about the Internet and its democratizing value than I do, so I don't want to pretend to be an expert on the topic. But I would say that now, with the kinds of information that's accessible on the Internet, there are alternatives, which means people can remain, can be informed. Of course, you always could have been informed, but now you can be informed, in my opinion, with relative ease. It's not difficult anymore. And I find, frankly, and maybe I should be embarrassed to say so, but I don't read the Times that much anymore. I don't feel like I'm missing anything by not reading the mainstream media generally. If I want to know about Iraq, I'll turn to Juan Cole's website. If I want to, you know, read about Israel-Palestine, I'll turn to, you know, or the Middle East generally, I'll turn to Robert Fisk, and I know basically where to go to get a reasonable picture. It is true to say, however, that since Israel and its apologists in the past 2 or 3 years began this a fraudulent campaign about a new anti-Semitism, since then, a lot of the media that used to be good, like the British Guardian, has now become more timid. That campaign has had an effect. It has browbeaten, intimidated some of the media. I would say, fortunately, it has not had an effect on human rights organizations. I follow their publications quite closely, and you can get a very clear, a very honest picture of what's going on in the occupied territories. If you look at the Amnesty International, the Human Rights Watch, the Israeli organization B'Tselem, their websites, their bulletins, and press notices, and so forth, they're quite good. I want to say, and I, you know, I'm speaking here as an old-fashioned, a pretty old-fashioned leftist, who used to find the L word, a liberal, as reprehensible as any other term, I have to say that these organizations, which are generally very moderate in their politics, I would have to say their standards of documentation, their honest attempts to read the meaning of the law and not to twist or bend out of shape the law, I would have to say it's very impressive, and I humbly express my respect for them. They do an excellent job, and I include their Human Rights Watch, which I used to be very critical of, I would say in recent years is not bad.
We're talking to Norman G. Finkelstein today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Norman Finkelstein is the author of several books, including the brand new Beyond Chutzpah on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history. He's also written The Holocaust Industry, an international bestseller, and Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict, among others. If you'd like to call in, our number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller waiting patiently. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Finkelstein.
Good afternoon. What a sublime irony of history that Benjamin Disraeli may turn out to be more progressive than Theodore Herzl and the Jewish Bund in European revolutionary social democracy. Disraeli's policy of Jewish Orientalism, and if I can just thumbnail sum that up, is the gradual migration and assimilation into Middle Eastern society, Semitic culture, which is to say Arab culture. Disraeli said that the Arabs were nothing but Jews who ride camels. Norman, we're all worried about you. I think you should hire a bodyguard. Now, old man Trotsky didn't hire a very good one down there in Coyoacan, Mexico, 65 years ago. But when you spoke here, I saw the hatred in the eyes of much of the audience, and a lot of us would volunteer. But Alan Dershowitz told me on a call-in program on this station that, well, Trotsky was wrong about everything. Well, Donath Coyoacan said that the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine could be nothing but a bloody trap. And so you might just put that on the plate, and we'll see what we get. Thank you for taking my call, sir.
Well, thank you very much. And, Norman, I'd like you to respond to some of the historical references the caller made, because I suspect many of our listeners are unfamiliar with what he was talking about. But before you do that, or after you do that, you can pick your choice. We talked about the sort of personal criticism and attacks you have taken. And I want to note for the record that one of the reasons why we put you on the show so quickly was the report that came out that two bookstores had canceled events for Beyond Chutzpah under pressure. And I found that rather offensive personally, and I wanted to make sure you had a chance to speak your side. So why don't you talk about both those issues a little bit, if you would, please?
Well, let me speak on the second issue first. You mentioned that I received a review from Publishers Weekly, and frankly, I was surprised to even receive that. It happened that there were a number of stories published in Publishers Weekly on the controversy with Dershowitz. I'm not sure how many of your listeners are aware, but for the past 15 months, Dershowitz has attempted in quite extraordinary ways to suppress publication of my book, Beyond Chutzpah. He began, originally I was the book was supposed to come out from New Press, and he began writing in April 2004 these multi-page single-space letters. Usually they were six pages, each of the letters, to the head of New Press, and then to all the under separate envelopes, to every member of the New Press editorial board. As I said, each of the letters was about six pages, single spaced, and then New Press wanted to defer publication of the book before they had more time to prepare for what they expected to be a quite vicious onslaught by Dershowitz. I was concerned about the timeliness of publication, and so I withdrew under a provision of the contract, and I went to University of California Press. When Dershowitz got wind of the fact that it was University of California Press, it seems he was even more enraged, because he was trying to force me to publish with a press lacking any credibility so that he can say that no reputable press would publish Finkelstein's garbage. And instead, the press I went to had, at least in the eyes of academics, it had more credibility. It was a university press. And then he started escalating his attack. No point in going through all of his initiatives. I'll just discuss the main ones. His first main initiative was to go to the governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, to stop publication of the book. Schwarzenegger, to his credit, and we have to be fair about these things, I think, to his credit, he stated that he refuses to intervene in a matter of academic freedom, and so he won't do anything. After Dershowitz failed to get the Terminator on his side, he hired the most powerful, what is reputed to be the most powerful law firm in the country, Kravath, Swain, and Moore, and they start to bombard University of California Press with letters trying to block publication of the book. And I have to say, without going into details, that the threats by Dershowitz were having a real effect. The Boston Globe quoted him as saying to University of California Press, "Have you published Finkelstein's book?" Quote, "I'm going to own your company." And University of California Press was very concerned. It's a university press, which means its resources are finite. In fact, they're very small. And they were not worried so much about winning the case as they were of the litigation costs. As the head of University of California Press told me, she said, "Look, Norman, you don't understand. These cases never get to court. They're always out of court settlements, and it's after huge amounts of money squandered in litigation." And she said, "If Dershowitz files the lawsuit in New York, we can't even afford to fly people out from California." And so they were. The threats were very real. That they were going to be bankrupted by this by Dershowitz, and it began to cause real problems in my relationship with University of California Press. That was finally settled. The book is out, but this whole process, to return to my original comment, this whole process received quite wide coverage in the media, in The Nation magazine, the Los Angeles Times, Publishers Weekly, and all sorts of other places, including Tiny Items.
You know, if I can interject briefly, Norman Finkelstein, listeners who are interested in seeing the record here and looking at some of the transcripts and articles that Professor Finkelstein is referring to can go to his website, which is www.normanfinkelstein.com, and you'll find a wealth of material, including some interviews with Professor Dershowitz.
Right. Well, you won't find, unfortunately, you won't find copies of the letters that Dershowitz sent to these places. He's now in denial mode, claiming he didn't threaten this and he didn't threaten that and so on and so forth. And I've simply put forward one simple request. You claim you didn't? Fine. Just publish the letters. Let's see what you wrote, New Press. Let's see what you wrote, University of California Press. And let's see what you wrote, Governor Schwarzenegger. And then people can judge for themselves who's telling the truth. But he's adamantly refused to post the letters for reasons which I think are obvious. In any event, to return to the original question, so it got coverage, and including extensive coverage in Publishers Weekly and a lot of coverage in the Chronicle of Higher Education. It was the front page story in the Chronicle of Higher Ed. And so consequently, I got a review in Publishers Weekly. But my guess is I'm not going to get any reviews for the book. It's going to be a complete washout in the mainstream press. You know, that's how they operate. The way the mainstream press works, and I have, you know, a lot of experience, I think, in these matters, is they do everything they can to black you out. You don't exist. That's what happened with the Holocaust industry. But then there comes a point, if the point comes, when they can no longer ignore you, then they get a hatchet man to destroy you. And so the New York Times, with the Holocaust industry, got this fellow, Omer Bartov, to write this full page in the Sunday Times Book Review, which was just an uninterrupted stream of abuse against me. Finkelstein is this, that, and that. No mention of the content of the book, let alone the arguments in the book. And there's a certain, I think, misunderstanding by many people about what happens when you get a negative review in the New York Times. A lot of people make the argument, bad publicity is better than no publicity. That's not really true, and I'm going to just quickly explain why.
Okay.
If you get a bad review in the New York Times, number one, it sends the signal to all librarians across the country, don't purchase this book. So when the New York Times writes, Finkelstein's book is anti-Semitic, it's like the protocols of the elders of Zion, every librarian now gets the message, this is anti-Semitic. If you're Jewish and a librarian, you don't want it. If you're not Jewish and you're a librarian, you won't touch it. So there goes all the library sales. The second thing that happens when you get a bad review in the New York Times is it kills all second and third tier reviews. So you may still get a review in the Los Angeles Times. You may still get a review in the Washington Post because they're semi-independent. They have they're intellectually autonomous. But the second and third tier newspapers, they all look to the Times, the Sunday Times Book Review, to decide which books are important and which books are not important. And then there's that third category, which books are untouchable. And so when you get that anti-Semitic Protocols of Zion review in the Times, the second and third tier, they won't touch it. It's over. And so I had the case with the Holocaust industry. Even though it was translated into 18 languages, it was an international bestseller. In Germany, it sold 130,000 copies in 3 weeks. It was on the bestseller list in places everywhere from Brazil to Italy. In the United States, and now this is literally the case, literally, I had no television, one radio interview with my good friend Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, and I had around 4 or 5 reviews of the book, and that was it.
We're talking to Norman Finkelstein today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're discussing not only his new book, Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and abuse of history, but he's just been talking about the Holocaust industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering, which came out 10 years ago, with the second edition 2 years ago. If you'd like to call in to Media Matters, our phone number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We've got a couple callers patiently waiting, but before we get to them, I'd like to get to a little bit of history because I want our listeners to understand that there's a lot of meat in these books. In the history of Israel, it seems like 1967 is a decisive year for changes in not just Israel but also the U.S.-Israeli relationship. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Well, there are many aspects to what happened in June 67. There are aspects regarding.
I've got to say first, Professor Finkelstein, that a lot of our listeners, I should have said this earlier, won't even know what happened in 1967
okay.
in Israel. So you might have
Fair
to
enough.
Start from the very beginning.
Fair enough. Okay, the State of Israel is founded in June 1948, and Israel's borders constitute basically the whole of what was called British-mandated Palestine, the area that British had a mandate over after World War I, and the only areas of Palestine which the State of Israel did not cover are the areas that came to be called the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The Gaza Strip, up until June 1967, was under the military control of Egypt, and the West Bank was annexed, though it was not internationally recognized, it was annexed by Jordan. In June 1967, during what's called the Six-Day War, but I prefer just to call it the June 1967 War, in the course of the June 1967 war, Israel radically expanded its borders. It militarily occupied the West Bank, it militarily occupied Gaza, it militarily occupied the Syrian Golan Heights, and it occupied the Sinai, the Egyptian Sinai. And there are many changes occurred as a result of the Israel's victory in the June 67 war. It would be difficult to go through all of them, but to give you the basic picture, first of all, because Israel proved itself to be a formidable military power in the Middle East, it quickly became or caught the eye of the United States and quickly became transformed into what was called a strategic asset of the United States. And so now Israel was firmly aligned with the U.S. Up until June 67, the U.S. had an ambivalent relationship with Israel, sometimes very strong, sometimes weaker, depending on U.S. administration. The main arms supplier of Israel up until June 67 was not the U.S., but France. So Israel becomes politically a strategic asset of the United States. As a result of that relationship, as well as all of the corruptions that I think are attendant on any occupation, many aspects of, I think people would argue, and I think fairly, I don't want to get into these questions because it becomes very complicated, but I think people would argue, and I think fairly, F-A-I-R-L-Y, meaning reasonably, that many of the decent aspects of Israeli society and aspects of Israeli society which, even in the face of how it was founded and even in the face of the racism and chauvinism of Israeli society, there were aspects of Israeli society which were genuinely impressive. The experiments, the social experiments like the kibbutzim, the relatively equitable distribution of wealth, and so on and so forth, that as a result of the relationship it entered into with the United States, as well as the occupation itself, many aspects, or the positive features of Israeli society were over time corrupted. So I think that's another consequence of the June 1967 war, not at all to glorify what Israel was like before June 67, but I think also in fairness to recognize there were certainly aspects of Israeli society which many people on the left have found quite admirable, and I think probably with justification.
We're talking to Norman Finkelstein today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone line, again, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Norman Finkelstein's a professor of teaches political theory at DePaul University in Chicago and the author of the new book, Beyond Chutzpah, and the Misuse of Antisemitism and the Abuse of History. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Norman Finkelstein.
Hi. The last time I checked, I think your book about your year in mainly the Gaza was not available.
Which book?
There is a book that you wrote on your firsthand experience of living there.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I forget the title at this point.
The Rise and Fall of Palestine.
Yeah. Right. Based on the fact that Haaretz has actually, in the last couple of days, called the Gaza extraction a ploy, basically, and the fact that you have so much to add, that is there any chance that after getting over surmounting the publishing of this book, you might be able to bring that back with a afterword or something? The other thing was my brother converted to Judaism, and he and his wife were gifted just a couple of years ago from time immemorial, so we may call it gone and forgotten and debunked, but I'm afraid that it still has credibility in too widespread circles, and that's why Dershowitz probably plagiarized it so well. I know you're not supposed to say that yourself, so
I'll say what I want.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm sure you will. Bye.
Thank you, caller. Do you want to discuss?
Well, just a couple of things there. First of all, I've not read any serious commentary on the Gaza pullout, which states anything other than the situation for Palestinians is almost certainly going to deteriorate after the pullout. And what's more, and again, it's quite interesting, I found it at least interesting, none of the human rights organizations, you look at the statement that was issued August 19th by Human Rights Watch, or you look at the very large report that was issued by B'Tselem, I think it was in March, I could be wrong on that, in March, entitled Gaza, One Big Prison. All of the reports state that Israel's disengagement does not mean the occupation is over of Gaza. Of Gaza. I'm not talking about the West Bank now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you will never find that in the mainstream media. Mainstream human rights organizations are saying, under international law, Israel still maintains military control over Gaza. It controls the airspace. It controls the water. It controls the borders. It has full military control over Gaza. The occupation under international law hasn't changed one jot. You can't find that in the mainstream media.
Yeah, what about the Israeli media? Is it a similar range as the U.S. media?
I think it's one has to be cautious about generalizing.
Yeah.
Many people rely on, including myself, the translations that we get from Haaretz and so forth. But the fact that you're getting translated one very good newspaper doesn't mean you gain the full range of Israeli media.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what the full range is showing. What's clear is that media, which is well within the mainstream, some of it is quite good. And you couldn't find anything the equivalent of it, which is well within the mainstream in the U.S. But that doesn't mean the full range or even the majority is good. That I couldn't comment on.
We're talking to Norman Finkelstein today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The number again, 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, I got your book earlier this week, and I've read through the first 50 pages or so, and I think it's the best thing you've written, which is saying a lot. I'm wondering how the New York Times is going to deal with this. I mean,
they can't deal with it.
They can't pull another.
As that. They, yeah. I don't want to stop you short, and I and believe me when I say I'm grateful for your favorable comment.
Yeah,
you know, it was. I'm not comparing myself to a stone thrower in Gaza who has to face an Israeli tank.
Yeah.
But it was a real struggle to get that book out, and it was, for me, there are moments where I really had to ask myself whether this is worth it. I was, you know, to be candid, I was even losing many close friends over it because there were many different judgments about how to proceed along the way with people telling me to just agree to everything the press was saying, and I should say parenthetically, it was not the press that was saying it. It was libel lawyers that were saying it. There were five libel lawyers brought in by University of California Press, and they were effectively calling the shots. And I could not agree with many of their judgments because I didn't think they knew what they were talking about. They may be good lawyers, but they're not good. They don't know the history, and they don't know the facts. They were simply picking at any word which they thought Dershowitz was going to file a libel suit on the basis of. And so there were many moments where I was half losing my mind over this. So I'm very grateful, you know, for your kind words.
I've read the Appendix 2 also, which is a brief history lesson, and you have Dershowitz dead to rights, which is not difficult, of course. But I mean, they can't pull another Omar Bartov on you.
No,
they can't. They can't ignore you. So what are
they
going to do?
I think they can. I think what they're going to do now, my guess is, you know, it's a prediction. I could be wrong. Alan Dershowitz just came out with a new book. Again, book in quotes.
A Case for Peace.
A Case for Peace. And my guess is they are not going to review it, first of all, because the book is an embarrassment to begin with. But secondly, they're not going to review it, and they're going to say, in fairness, We're not reviewing Finkelstein, and we're not reviewing Dershowitz. And that's how they're going to get around the obligation to review. Because you have to understand, they can't review that book for two reasons. Number one, the book is based entirely on mainstream human rights organizations. So they can't dismiss me as a crackpot. Now I'm using Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, the Israeli Committee Against Torture in Israel, the Physicians for Human Rights in Israel. Those are my only sources for the second, for the two-thirds of the book. That's it, nothing else. So they can't dismiss it as crackpot. Number two, now they have a big problem. They have lent their name, because Ethan Bronner wrote the review, they have lent their name, Ethan Bronner being the New York Times editorial board member, expert on the Middle East, they have lent their good name to Dershowitz's book. Now, how are they going to look now if they have to publicly acknowledge that Dershowitz's book is a complete fraud, which means, what does that say about their resident expert on the Middle East who praised the book? They can't do it. And so I think they're going to use, they're going to say that the, you know, the dispute between Finkelstein and Dershowitz, it's all personal, it's all petty, we don't want to get involved in this sandbox fight. I can see all the cliches coming, and we're not going to review Finkelstein, and we're not going to review Dershowitz, and they're going to pretend now they're taking the high moral ground. You know,
well, yeah. The book is doing pretty well on the Amazon.com website.
It's doing okay. You know, in light of all the pre-publication publicity for the book, according to my University of California Press, there are exactly two reviews scheduled for it, The Nation magazine and ZNet.
Yes.
Two reviews. And no, as of now, apart from what I'm doing this moment, and I expect that Amy Goodman will have me back, apart from that, no radio, no television. I'm not surprised.
Well,
because I think they're in a real problem now. They're in a real dilemma.
Well,
you
those
know,
of us,
Holocaust industry in many ways was like it was what the subtitle is. It's reflections on. It was a personal statement, though documented, especially in the second half. This book adheres to the strictest standards of academic scholarship. It won endorsements from the chair of the sociology department at the Hebrew University, a university chair at Oxford University, a senior researcher at Harvard University, a chair in Judaic studies at Berkeley, all of whom, by the way, are Jewish. They have a real problem now. How are you going to discredit it?
Well, those of us who've been following you for years and have seen you go from, I guess, what's called obscurity to really what isn't obscurity anymore, really know that you'll hang in there and keep going.
Oh, I'll hang in there.
Hope that you will and really, really appreciate what the work that, you, that
well,
you've done.
Thank you very much, caller, for calling in. Much appreciated. Norman Finkelstein, our guest today in Media Matters. So we've only got a handful of minutes left, Norman. Let's talk for a second. We've alluded to your book, The Holocaust Industry, several times. What is the Holocaust industry?
The Holocaust industry, as I mentioned a moment ago, it was in its original edition. It's not anymore. It's come out in several new editions. It was a pretty small book, which was, as the subtitle indicates, reflections on the exploitation of Jewish suffering. Both my late parents were survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. Both were in the Warsaw Ghetto from May 1939 to April. I'm getting the dates wrong, you'll excuse me. They were in the Warsaw Ghetto from September 1939 to May 1943. When the Warsaw Ghetto uprising was put down, those who were alive, there were about several tens of thousands still alive, about 30,000. They were taken to Majdanek concentration camp. Both of my parents were sent to Majdanek concentration camp. My mother went from Majdanek concentration camp to two slave labor camps. My father went to Auschwitz, where he was for 2 years, and then was on the Auschwitz death march. And so I grew up in what you would call, I don't think there was any stereotypical Holocaust home, but I definitely grew up in a Holocaust home, sort of the hallmarks of which were I never had any relatives, never had any aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents. Everyone was exterminated during the war. And I think it's fair to say, and I understand it more as I get older, the damage that was done to my parents was profound and enduring in every sense of the word, literally to the last days of each of their lives. You could feel the weight they were bearing from what they experienced. And the book was basically about how I, in my opinion, the Nazi Holocaust had been turned into a weapon which was being used for political and ideological gain. Political and financial gain. Political gain was turned into a weapon rarely after the June 1967 war. It was turned into a weapon to immunize Israel from criticism. It's no time now to go into it, but it would surprise many of your listeners to know that not only did Nazi Holocaust have virtually no presence in American life up until June 67, it had virtually no presence in American Jewish life until June 1967. Even Alan Dershowitz, who's, you know, a premier Holocaust monger, if you read his autobiography to the extent that anything in the book has any relationship to the real world, you read his book, Chutzpah, and his other publications, he says over and over again that growing up, I'm quoting him, I don't recall ever having a single discussion about the Holocaust. And that's absolutely accurate. It didn't exist in American Jewish life, let alone American life generally, before the June 1967 war. And so a large part of the Holocaust industry is given over to a discussion of how the Nazi Holocaust came to be used as, serve as, an ideological weapon to immunize Israel from criticism. And then in more recent years, the Nazi Holocaust was used as an extortion weapon, a blackmail weapon, as the dean of Nazi Holocaust scholars, Raoul Hilberg, put it, a blackmail weapon to blackmail Europe in the name of what was called Holocaust compensation and needy Holocaust victims, all of which was pure and simple fakery. And especially in more recent editions of the book, it's now, I think it started off at 120 pages, I think now it's about 350 pages, I go through a minute analysis of the documentary record of what was done, for example, with the Swiss banks.
Thank you very much for that explanation, Norman Finkelstein, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesson, here in WILL AM 580. Norman, we've only got a few seconds left.
Well, in a few seconds, I want to say something to you.
Please do.
One of the biggest influences on me growing up was Monthly Review. I was one of those odd fellows who used to, at the beginning of each month, go up to the Monthly Review office, which was located on 14th Street and 6th Avenue. Probably you don't even know that.
Yeah, it predates me.
And I used to go up, and I would be sitting at the desk asking Roz, who was his secretary, begging her for the first issue off the press, because I had to know the last word from the editors of Monthly Review on the burning political questions of the day.
Well, thank you.
One of the people who really was very kind, very generous, and instrumental in allowing me to become what I wanted to become was Paul Sweezy.
Well, thank you. On that note, we've got to say goodbye. See you all next week on Media Matters.
Beginning next month, the Sunday afternoon broadcast of A Prairie Home Companion will be changing frequencies. It will be moving from AM 580 to our companion station, FM 90.9, where it's also heard Saturday evenings at 5. We hope you'll enjoy Tavis Smiley's weekly program, Sunday afternoons on AM 580. For more information, consult your September Patterns magazine or the FAQ, F-A-Q section we'll be posting soon on our website. Or you may call or write Program Director Jay Pierce here at the station.
We'll see a diminishing chance for some isolated showers and thunderstorms as the day goes on today in and around Champaign-Urbana. A high near 88, mostly clear tonight, low 58, and then tomorrow mostly sunny with a high of 85. Southwesterly winds around 10 today, light winds tonight and tomorrow. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College.